Hey everyone, Dan here. Not gonna lie, the following podcast was a tough one to do, and it may be a tough one to listen to. In this episode, retired school teacher and longtime 403B advocate Steve Shulo talks about the recent sudden loss of his longtime partner Dan Robertson. I also talk about the loss of my first wife Julie to breast cancer 15 years ago. Steve and I discuss the emotional pain and some of the financial realities when you lose a loved one.
All right, well, we're on location today in Rancho Mirage, California. Dan Otter flew out from Albuquerque, New Mexico to hang out with me, and we decided to drive out to see our good friend, Steve Shulo. So we're actually at Steve Shulo's house. And Steve, I'm going to start this out by, tell us a little bit about this house. It has a unique history.
Yeah, it has a Hollywood connection. It was Jane Wyman's house, her last house that she died in this house, and the real estate agent had to disclose that information to us. Anybody that dies in the house, they have to tell it. And so we bought this house in 2008, Dan and I. And we did a lot of remodeling. It was a mess, and it had old Southwestern decor, and we put
Hey,
new
I live in the Southwest. Don't make fun of that.
I like nothing wrong with the Southwest.
I'm just kidding.
So we put in all kinds of new stuff and put solar panels on the roof, and we got two electric cars, and so we're ready to beat inflation in retirement.
You know what the irony is? Didn't Ronald Reagan famously pull solar panels off the White House as one of his first acts? I don't think he physically went on the roof, but I think he had them taken down, right?
No, it was, I got that story straight
because okay,
I thought the same thing. No, they were taken down they had to do something to the White House roof, and it was maintenance, and he just didn't put them back.
Okay.
And so we had some retribution here. We put solar panels on Jane Wyman's house. And for those of you that don't know Jane Wyman, she was the first wife of President Ronald Reagan. And they had two kids, Michael Reagan, who we bought the house from, and who was the other? Maureen Reagan. She had died of cancer about 10 years ago. Anyway, that was a little bit of trivia that you can tell your people people at your party.
I do all the time, actually. Well, we're actually, our listeners might recall from episode 8, Steve Shulo was on. We did a great podcast with Steve and with his husband, Dan Robertson. And a lot has happened since that episode. And so today's podcast is going to be a little bit more serious. Dan Robertson passed away recently, and what we're going to focus on today is not only Steve Shulo and what has gone on over the past few months, but also Dan Otter. A lot of you don't know that Dan, his wife of 11 years, passed away in July or in 2001. Steve was married to Dan Robertson, who passed away recently, and they were together for about 40 years. So we really wanted to use this time to talk about these amazing individuals, and also touch a little bit on financial stuff. Let's start out by doing this. Steve, could you talk a little bit about Dan Robertson? Tell us a little bit about him. I know it's difficult, but Dan Otter here and myself, we love Dan. He was a great guy. We loved him on the podcast. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, I met Dan in 1975. We were right nearby in Big Bear. We were at a workshop. Back in those days, they had a lot of encounter groups and growth workshops, psychological growth workshops, and that's where we met. And when I met Dan, I knew he was the person that was right for me. I don't know. I just knew it. Something clicked in me. And I was 27 at the time, and I knew that he was the one for me for the rest of my life. That's what that was in my thinking. And Dan wasn't quite ready yet, but he came around within a few months. And so we moved in together that summer. And it's really been just wonderful. All these years, we knew we were lucky to have each other. And it was, you know, love at first sight. We both had previous relationships, and so that helped. So Dan wasn't my first relationship, and I wasn't his first relationship. So throughout the years, we educated, we helped each other finish college, and then we, you know, we wrote our book. I'm fast forwarding it to the last 7 years, and then we learned a lot of things together, especially finances, and we'll be talking about that real soon here. And that was the last podcast, what, number 8, we talked about our finances. And so he was just, he had a sense of humor, which I needed, a sense of humor. I'm Italian, I'm a little bit more serious. So I know Dan and Scotty, you two knew him. Everybody he met just really liked him a lot because of his sense of humor, and he would listen to people. He would strike up conversations with anybody. What sometimes would drive me nuts, he would be talking with anybody.
That sounds like another Dan I know.
He was just a wonderful, wonderful human being. And he was 6 years older than me, so he's kind of like a mentor to me too over the years. And we grew into be almost like twin brothers. So when he got sick and died, it was so fast that I was in shock for 2 months afterwards. I don't know if we want to get into that right now.
I think we'll why don't we talk, so I want to give Dan Otter here a chance to talk too, and then we'll come back to that. But I do want to share real quickly, I thank you, Steve, for inviting me to Dan's memorial. I've met Dan several times. We've had dinner, many, you know, lunch and dinner, and he was always really humorous, like you said. But I didn't know how. I didn't know that was just like part of his personality. And at the memorial, what I really enjoyed was listening to all these people stand up and tell the funniest stories about Dan and the things that he would do and the stuff that he would say. It cracked me up. And I just want to say that was so inspirational for me to mm-hmm. hear these things. Like, that's the way. I think that was such a beautiful tribute to Dan. Mm-hmm. So I was honored to be there. Thank you for that. Dan Otter. I've known Dan. I met Dan right after his wife passed away. In fact, I did not know that his wife had passed away until we got together the summer after Dan's first wife. Dan's first wife, Julie, passed away. We got together to write a book. And I remember sitting in a conference room in Irvine, California, and Dan and I going through all of our notes to prepare to write this book. And just, I don't know what brought it up, but Dan said, yeah, my wife passed away about 3 months ago or 6 months ago. And I just kind of stopped, and like I literally started to tear up. I needed to leave the room. I couldn't believe that he was sitting in the room with me after all this. And it it turned out that it was something that could take his mind off of what had happened, something else he could focus on. But Dan Otter, tell us about your first wife, Julie. Tell us a little bit about her.
So I met Julie in 1986 when we were both going to San Diego State. She was the sister of one of my best friends, Greg. And Greg and I had met, we were fraternity pledge bros. And he had invited me that summer after we were, you know, had joined this fraternity, Alpha Tau Omega. Greg had invited me along with his family to Mexico. And so we were in Puerto Vallarta, and Julie brought a friend. and we were going out and dancing and having a good time. And I just got the sense that she was looking at me a certain way, and you know, all these emotions, like, this is one of my best friend's sisters. Is that a line? I don't know if I want to cross that. Her dad, you know, was there, and her other brother. And so I just kind of, just in the back of my mind, I thought, maybe something could happen there. And this was in the summer before school started. And it turns out that Julie was going to be then beginning San Diego State the next year. She was 2 years younger than me. And I kind of got the sense that there was an interest on her part. And I remember we were at our fraternity house, and she had ridden over on a bike. And there was a bunch of my friends who were sitting in front of the fraternity house. And I could tell there was a lot of interest in Julie by my fraternity friends. And I remember thinking, oh man, I got to jump in here. All right, it's going to be, you know, I'm going to not have this opportunity with what looks to be a pretty amazing person. Her family is just phenomenal. Her brother is just this amazing, loving, gregarious, positive person. And it clearly, those attributes were in Julie and just in spades. And Julie, sadly, had recently lost her mom to breast cancer, maybe 2 years earlier. No, I want to say a year earlier. So sadly, it is really in this family. But like you, Steve, when you mentioned like a love at first sight, I knew that Julie was an unbelievably special person, and I would be lucky to be able to go out with her. And it just was so obvious to me that she was this amazing person. And I don't know if it was September, I think I finally asked her out, and she was like so happy. And literally, we just spent almost every moment together for the next several months. And the funny thing is, Greg had a house that he rented out to us, and he lived there. And then Julie lived next door at a house their aunt and uncle owned. So she was the girl next door, and I was the boy next door. So we dated all through college, junior year for me, senior year. And it's funny, I'm the one that I'd read an article about the need for teachers in California. And I had suggested to her, you know, you might want to look into this profession. So Julie became a teacher, and she's the reason I became a teacher. I was a reporter in Corona right after college, and I grew up in Orange County, so I would go back home on the weekend for the week, and then I would drive down to San Diego State, spend the weekend in San Diego, and then get up at 5 a.m. and drive up. And then we got married in 1990. She began teaching first grade, and I would go into her classroom and help her. And that's when I decided, wow, I think I wouldn't mind being a teacher. So not only was she just this amazing person with just such a loving, open-minded approach to life, but she's the reason that I went into teaching. So that's just a little snapshot about this just amazing person.
Wow. Steve, thank you for sharing. Dan, thanks for sharing. They both were amazing people. That's really interesting that 403 BYs would not be here today had you not met Julie.
I think so. I mean, I would not have had the kind of insight on teaching, and I certainly probably wouldn't have gone into the field unless I had seen what it was like. And I think it was, I worked as a reporter for the small publication in Corona, California called Corona This Month. So I did that for about 4 years. And that's what's so great about 403 BYs. It's combining my love of education with my love of writing. So those two things kind of coming together.
And your love of sarcasm and wit.
I appreciate that. I do like to have a little sarcasm in my life. helps me get through the day.
Good. Well, so Steve, I want to switch back to you. I want you to talk a little bit about the illness. I think both of your loved ones passed away of some form of cancer. I think all of our lives have been affected in some form or fashion. Steve, you are a cancer survivor.
Yes, I am.
And so, Steve, why don't you start? Tell us a little bit about what happened and what the illness was.
It was a form of leukemia. Dan had not been feeling good for several weeks, and we had been We had a trip planned to go to Vietnam because I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I wanted to go and see if I could find where I was stationed in Vietnam. So I was looking forward to going on this trip. And Dan was the type of person, he didn't complain very much. And he, you know, he, over the years, you know, we go through flu seasons and all that stuff. So it just sounded like to me that he was having symptoms of flu. And so he was hanging low, hoping to kick it before we went. The day that we were supposed to get in the car and go to LAX, he wakes me up at 3 a.m. and he says, "Steve, take me to the emergency. We're not going to Vietnam." And wow, that was my wake-up call. And so I took him to emergency, which is Eisenhower Hospital right next door here. And the first thing that happened that was this is serious is that they came back with his blood results, and his white blood cell count was through the roof. He's got leukemia. And so he was transferred to another hospital because we were under Kaiser. And he just went downhill really fast because he had to, it was too late to really do any treatment. The cells took over his lungs. He only had 2/3 of his lungs were taken over. He only had 1/3 breathing capacity. And we managed, you know, to say our goodbyes, you know, and you know, all this time I'm just in shock. This has just happened within just a few days, and I just never heard of a form of leukemia that was this aggressive. It's called acute blastic leukemia, and the doctor says that the bone marrow just goes haywire and shoots out these bad cells into the system. And it was too late to have chemo, and Dan didn't want it. He was prepared to die. And excuse me. he was sorry that he was going to let me go, that he was leaving me behind. And he was afraid, and I told him, "Don't be afraid," because that's what he always told me. So I was just, you know, reporting it back to him. Not be afraid. And he wasn't afraid. He wasn't afraid after that. He died in peace. And the doctor said that he couldn't stand the chemo anyway. He was too far. He was too weak. He didn't eat all that whole time he was in the hospital. And I had some friends with me to make this decision of, you know, letting him die, or is there a chance of treatment and all that stuff? And the doctor said, no, there's no chance that he could recover. He'd probably die he would need chemo. And my friends were there, and one of them says, you know, I made the right decision. It's a, you know, anybody that's been in this decision of, you know, having a choice of should we try and keep him alive or allow him to die. The thing about Dan, as we were talking about earlier, he wasn't afraid to talk about anything. We talked about this stuff. What would happen if, you know, I had a terminal illness? He already said, I already knew what he wanted. He did not want to go through the chemo and maybe live a year or two and then wonder if he's going to survive. I know he didn't want that. And he was so sick. He was barely conscious at the end. And so, you know, he was very courageous. And he died on October 20th at 11:20. I was there, and his sister Bonnie and my niece Linda were there when he passed. And it was, you know, everything just stopped working and he passed away. And so he gave me courage to face my own death, because we're all going to die someday. So now it's our time to live. And we had talked about, we knew we were lucky to have each other all these years, And the memorial that Scotty was talking about was, that's what I think about when I have my bad days. I think about that memorial, all those great things that people said about Dan. And that really made me feel good how, you know, lucky I was to be with him 24/7 for 40 years. And, you know, his friends would see him whenever, you know, not as much as me. And it was really, really a great thing to have that organized. That was one thing we didn't talk about, was a memorial. He was cremated, and his ashes are buried up on the tram. And just like what we talked about, we used to hike up there up on top of the tram here in Palm Springs. I'm talking about the Palm Springs tram. There's a state park up there. And we just had a discussion about that last summer about where we want to be buried. And so that's where he's buried, and his family was here. And I've gotten a lot closer to everybody. My own family from Wisconsin, I had a grandniece and her husband and their 7-month-old baby boy came out and saw me. So I've gotten close to both families. Everybody was devastated. It wasn't just me, it was everybody that knew Dan, and Dan's sister was really devastated by this. I mean, we're all in shock about this, about how could this happen so quickly. So it's been 5 months now, and time does heal. I go to a bereavement group, and I continue the work that Dan and I have done. I still write on my blog. And I'm revising our book. We started revising it last year, Late Bloomer Millionaires. And I'm going to be updating it and revising it. And I just did a workshop today at the Mizell Senior Center. And I said the same thing to them. You know, it was their bereavement group that I was giving a presentation to. And so part of the healing process, the recovery of grief, is to continue the work. I know Dan would be happy that I'm doing this, that I'm continuing the job that we had started several years ago. So that's, you got some more questions, Scotty?
No, no, I love it. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. You are very courageous. I mean, coming on this soon after is maybe asking a lot, but I think it's going to help our listeners and... Mm-hmm. And we, I personally, I love being able to almost do a little mini memorial for Dan here on the show because we thought so much mm-hmm. of him. I want to take you back. I remember getting an email from you and Dan, a very historic email. California was one of the first places to legalize gay marriage. And you guys were not the first, but like among the first to actually get married here in California. And I remember getting that email. I don't remember what year it is. You can tell us. But tell us a little bit about that experience and what year that was. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, there was two experiences. The first one was in 2004 when the mayor of San Francisco declared the county of San Francisco is going to have legalized marriage. So we wanted to be a part of that, so we went up there. We knew it probably wouldn't last or whatever. So, but we drove up there and we went to City Hall and got married and had that certificate. And this was in 2004. And then I remember coming back and going to work, going to my school, and showing my colleagues the marriage certificate. And everybody said congratulations, and it was the first time I actually felt, wow, this is really nice being married, you know, because all these years I was, don't want to be married, that's part of something else, that's something that's not me, but it was really nice feeling being married, you know.
Yeah.
And so that was the first experience. Of course, it was disallowed, whatever, annulled right. 6 months later. And then the second time was in 2008, which was, if I recall, it was unexpected. So there was a window between June, I forget how it made legal. I don't know if it was the Supreme Court or was it the California? Well, it was just California.
California.
So there's that window, and that's when we got legally married. We got married at the Palm Springs City Hall. And we had a friend, Bob, as our best man. we just wanted to get married. We, you know, we didn't want to have any big deal and have all the family and all that stuff. We just wanted to get married, and so we did. And that really made us talk about finances. It made the finances a lot easier, because we had, up until then, we had to have a living trust and all this other legal stuff.
Well, in fact, that's where I'm kind of going with this. And so I'm going to save this for a little bit later in the podcast, because I think this is a really good contrast to draw on. Because I had, you know, probably 15 years ago or about 13 years ago, I had another... I had a gay client who lost his spouse, lost his partner, and what he went through during the hospitalization process, and it was a nightmare, and it was terrible because he couldn't visit his partner, and a lot has changed since then, and I want you to tell us not yet, but here a little later in the podcast about, you know, the differences now and if. How this would have happened maybe even just 10 years ago, what the differences would have been. So we're going to come back to that. But I will never forget that email saying, I think it was like, we're married or something like that. It was great. I remember saying, congratulations, this is great. Good,
I don't remember.
Yeah, you said it. You sent us an email. I think there was even a picture or something. I don't know, but it was... I mean, it's historic. You're one of the first people to get married in the United States.
18,000 gay couples in California were married in 2008 in that window.
Yeah, that's...
And I don't remember the email, but...
I do.
I probably did.
I'll tell you later why. Dan Otter, I'd like to switch over to you. So... Steve, again, thank you so much for sharing. Dan, tell us about Julie's illness and what happened there.
Sure, I will do my best. So I don't know if I mentioned it earlier, but we got married in 1990. I was 25, a little bit young for my peer group, but in hindsight, I just am so glad we did that. That just gave us so much more time together. So we had a daughter born in 1998, Lily, who is an 18-year-old now. But in 2000, in January, Julie and I were teaching on different schedules. In California at the time, we had year-round schedule. And so that we could have maximum coverage for our daughter, Lily, Julie was on one track and I was on another. And so this meant that we were home. One of us was home for like three quarters of the year. And I was at school, and this is pre-cell phones. And I don't know if it was lunch or after lunch, I got a call in the office. You know, your wife wants to talk to you. And so I go up there, and Julie said that she had just got... It must have been early in the day, because she had just gotten out of the shower, and she noticed a lump. And as I said earlier, her mother had passed away from breast cancer. We're pretty sure her grandmother passed away from breast cancer. She has an aunt who two of the three daughters have had breast cancer but are living with it. We had been getting mammograms since, I would say, 2 or 3 years earlier. Julie had had a clean, so-called clean mammogram in November, so that was 3 months earlier. So when she called and said, I think I found a lump, you know, immediately both agreed, hey, let's go get it looked at. I was very cognizant of the fact that when people self-discover, it means they've discovered it early and your rates of survival go up. So while I was concerned, I felt like we had already taken some precautions. It was very healthy, exercised. Her mom, I believe, was 46 when she passed away. Julie was 29 at this time. So she went in, and we went in together. They did a biopsy, and I remember the doctor saying, it's probably nothing, but let's have a follow-up in a couple weeks. And so we weren't overly concerned. We felt like we had been doing all the right things. This was way too early. And so when we went for the follow-up, I took the day off from teaching, and we brought Lily to the appointment. And, you know, we're sitting there in the appointment room, and Lily is one and a half, and she's on the floor, And the doctor just walks in. He says, it's cancer. And I almost threw up. I was sitting on the table next to Julie. I almost vomited. My head just started spinning. So I can only imagine what Julie was going through, because she saw her mom. She was home. That's one of the reasons she didn't go away to college right away. She stayed home for her mom. And I just, oh my God, punch to the stomach. And you're just sitting there looking at Lily. This little beautiful thing is looking up at us, and we're just both crying. And this person is introduced to us and said, I'm going to help you navigate everything. And you just, and I think I thought of this afterwards. It's just like, that's the person you don't want to meet, because suddenly your life is going this direction. And I can't remember tons of things about that conversation. I remember getting in the car and saying, we're going to the beach. And we drove down to Laguna Beach. I was living in Anaheim Hills, California. We also had Kaiser, the Anaheim Kaiser. And I thought they handled it as well as can be handled. I don't have any issues with that. It's just, I don't know how you can ever be prepared for something like that. And so we're just walking on the beach, and Lily's kind of waddling in front of us. And I just, oh my God, all these things going through my head. And so we're talking, and I don't remember again the specifics of what we talked about, but we just sort of at that point reassured ourselves. You know, we kind of clearly had the wind knocked out of us, but we were together, we were at the beach, we knew it was early, the doctors said it was early, and I believe they had laid out some a plan of attack, what to do. And again, I don't know if we then talked later, but I know it involved getting a second opinion. We went up to UCLA, and I think literally the day we were up at UCLA, there had been some front page stories questioning various techniques. The way we treat breast cancer then, and maybe now as well, is very aggressive. Lots of chemotherapy. It's just brutal on the patient. And there was some controversy about that. And I don't remember the exact specifics, but I remember our timing was kind of bad, because there was this debate in the medical community, do we go one way or another? And so we listened to the folks at UCLA, and then we ultimately went to the City of Hope. We decided to go that summer, so I think it was June that we went for that. But in the meantime, we had to decide whether to remove the breast. I think that was the debate. Now that I think about it, there was, do you do the mastectomy or do you treat it with radiation? And so again, after having the second opinion, we opted for the mastectomy. And again, you think, be aggressive. And I think that was Julie's attitude. I've got this daughter, I've got this life, this full life to live, that I should be as aggressive as possible. So we scheduled the mastectomy, and what a just brutal process. I mean, you're having your body chopped, you know, just so almost barbaric. I hope someday we look back and say that we just, you know, don't do this anymore. But so we did that, and we had unbelievable support from our families, our friends. I mean, you really find out who your friends are in these kind of situations. And I am just very rich in friends. Greg, his brother Chris, his dad, my family, my brother, all my great friends who I grew up with, just amazing. And so, you know, we're told that everything's gone pretty well with the procedure. And then we have a follow-up, and we find out they test, I think they're called lymph nodes, in the arm, and it's to see if the cancer has spread, and 11 of the 17 lymph nodes are cancerous. So what the fuck, you know? We're just like, we just went through all of this, and now you've told us in this very short time that lymph nodes, 11 of 17 are cancerous. So we're now in stage 3, and I want to say this is February. And that might have been when we probably had our second opinions. No, I think then we got more opinions than on how aggressive do we want to be. And we opted to do, I think it's called a stem cell rescue at the City of Hope. But before we could do that, we had to begin the chemotherapy. And that was just another rough day. We drove to Kaiser, and you go to the certain floor where the chemotherapy is, and you open the door. And again, all these just amazingly courageous people in there. And, you know, they're in various stages of health, often without their hair, very weakened, to the people like us who are new to this. And we walk in, and we just both broke down. It was just like, oh my gosh, this is our reality now. And I remember how loving everybody was. They just, like, you know, come up to us, hug us, the nurses. They couldn't have been, like, more gentle. And you almost feel guilty, you know, because you walk in there and you just react this way. And these are these people who have already gone through these stages of grief. And so you go in there and you go through it. And initially it's, you're relatively, there's some normalcy. But then it starts to take effect. And this is, I know, I believe that this is an accurate description. It's basically poison that's going into your body in this attempt to kill these cancerous cells. And Julie just got weaker and weaker and lost her hair. And I can say without a doubt, this person was so courageous. Never once did I ever hear her say, why me, why me? She just put on such an amazing, brave face. And the way she was able to care for Lily and just interact with Lily. And it was amazing to watch Lily's reaction to this. And people say that Lily is an old soul. People that meet her remark at her maturity. And I'm convinced it was because of this. Lily experienced this. There were so many adults in her early life because my mom moved back from Pittsburgh and lived with us full time. We just had people constantly helping us, cooking food. I mean, it was just as crappy as the situation was, the support group we had in place was just phenomenal. And it was interesting. I actually found work to be a place of relief. I could go, because anyone that's taught, you taught elementary school, Steve, you know, your wife is a teacher, Steve, Scott, you know how once that bell rings, you can't think about anything else. It's just these kids. And I felt a sense of peace. I could focus on these kids because there was nothing I could do to help Julie during the days. My mom was there. Her dad, they rented an apartment near us. And I'd go back home and it would just be, you know, that situation. So we go to the City of Hope and it's 4 weeks of just increasingly more and more intense treatment. And again, I don't remember all the specific terminology, but basically I believe they take your white blood cells out of you. They hit you with almost as much cancer as you can take. They do something to the white blood cells that, for lack of a better word, you know, cleans them, and then they reintroduce them into your body with the idea that all the cancer's been killed and these, you now have healthy white blood cells, and this has been shown to work for a lot of people. And we became pretty good friends with another couple who were similar to our age. Around, Julie was 29, I was 31 at the time. And every day they would check your white blood cell count. And when you got to a certain number, you got to go home. And our friends got to go home about 2 or 3 days before us. And they kept saying, that's not a big deal. People respond to this differently. And so finally we got to go home. And it was just great to be back at our house because they have basically apartments set up there and you live there. And I was off from school and I stayed there and I just was there for all of her treatment, and then we'd go back to this apartment. So we go home, and it was just pretty apparent that something just wasn't right. She was getting these intense headaches, and we would go back, and they would say, well, we still are confident in the treatment. We think things are progressing well. And then she was vomiting, and she had this seizure, and it was just so terrible. Lily was just looking at her. I remember we got back from the City of Hope for one of these follow-up appointments, and we get home, and Lily comes running to the door to, like, hug Julie, and Julie just all of a sudden goes right to the bathroom and is vomiting. And I just remember this look in like Lily's eyes, just like, oh my gosh, what is going on? It's like total fear. And then you just, again, you just can't believe you're going through this and how your life has changed. And so the next day, my parents took Julie to the doctors, and it had gotten into her spinal fluid. It had somehow, during the treatment, gotten in there. And that's basically, you're looking at maintenance at that point. It's just one of the worst outcomes you can have. And so I just remember they called me in my classroom, and I just threw a desk. The kids were gone. I just threw, it was those chair-desk combinations, and I just threw it across the room. I was just so freaking pissed at this person who was so amazing, had done everything right, and this was our outcome. And then they tell you that all hope is not lost, and that we can start doing this radiation injections right into the spine. I mean, unbelievably painful. And so several times a week, I would drive Julie up to Los Angeles, and she would get these injections directly into her spine. And she was so weak, she would lay in the back of the car, and my dad let us use his car. I think it was like an Oldsmobile, this big, comfortable car. And that was November and December. And you just have time to talk and think. And it's just, you don't want to have that conversation. But we did talk a little bit about, what if this doesn't go any better? And I don't remember the specifics, but it was, just take care of Lily. I know you'll meet someone again. Just like the conversations you don't want to have. But you try to stay optimistic, and I will tell you, we had the most amazing Christmas. Whatever they did with that radiation or with those injections, oh, I'm sorry, she got radiation and injections. I think she got chemo injections into her spine and was getting radiation, I believe. Whatever they did, we had the most amazing Christmas. This was 2000, and
by about January 6th,
she started to lapse again. And I was homesick because the stress was off the charts, and I couldn't teach then. And I remember she had another seizure, and her dad was over at our house, and the fire department came, and at this point she was like 95 pounds, and you could just see the firefighter's face. And so they take her to the hospital. And, within 2 days, she was in a coma, and we're at home. Hospice has come, and it's just a matter of waiting for her to pass away. And I think she fought for about 5 days. And Lily would come up and kiss her, and, she was two now, and two and a half. And it was just, I'd go for walks, and you'd just be like, is my wife going to be alive when I come home? We just had so many friends and family there. It was pretty phenomenal. And then I think it was the night of the 20th of January. We were all gathered around her, like breathing slower, and more labored. And you're just thinking, gosh, it's probably best if she passes away. But then when it finally happens, you just, fuck, it's just like, that's it. So, yeah. The next day we went to church, and I felt her presence in like such a powerful way. And then I just was focused on Lily. I'm just like, I told myself, I'm just going to do whatever I can for her. I just want her life to be as good as possible. I'm going to be there for her. My work was amazing. My principal, Grace Eden Piercy. This was McKinley Elementary School in Corona, California. They just couldn't have been more supportive of me and my family. And so they told me to take as much time off as you can. And I spent several months at home, and just all of Lily's cousins lived in California. And so we just constantly were doing things. And I just, that's where I channeled my energy. I had Lily, and it was whatever.
I mean, I don't know what I would have done without her. I think I would have been pretty depressed. I think I would have been, I don't know. I don't know what I would have done, but I had that as an anchor. And of course, my family. Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dan, you're a very moving story.
Yeah. I know the feeling.
Dan, tell us real quickly. I mean, Julie meant a lot to everybody at that school. One time you told me that I think there's like a memorial for her at that school. Say the name of the school again.
Sure.
Talk about that.
So I taught at McKinley Elementary School, and Julie first started teaching at, it's called Lincoln Alternative School, but it's alternative, it's a public school, but they had a different curriculum. And when Julie passed away, you probably felt this too with Dan, people want to do something. They don't know what to do, but they want to do things. And some people brought food, and people were like giving me money, and I was just so wholly unprepared for that. And I remember my mom said, you know, you could do a couple things here. You could tell people to donate it to a cancer group. But that's just going to go into a big pile. Why don't we do something for Julie? And so we had people who wanted to donate money, and we created a memorial for Julie called Julie's Garden. And it's at Lincoln Elementary School in Corona, California. And what we did is, with their unbelievable support, we carved out an area in the middle of the campus where a classroom can sit. And we have all these benches where like 4 to 6 kids can sit on the benches, and there's trees, and it's this amazing area. And then there's a plaque talking about Julie and talking about Lily and Julie's time teaching at Lincoln. So we went by there probably 6 to 8 years ago, and I need to go back there again, but that now is there because of my mom, Barbara Otter's amazing suggestion. And then the other thing was, people started sending money for Lily, and I threw it all into a 529 plan. And Lily is going to turn 18 soon, and we have a significant amount of money of... portion of that money is because the overwhelmingly generous donations of people at that time. And now, it's interesting, we're doing this podcast now, this money is now going to be realized by Lily. It's crazy.
Wow. Wow. Dan, thank you so much for sharing that story. I know that was not easy. I hadn't even heard the entire story of her bits and pieces over the last 15 years. I'm sure it wasn't easy.
I haven't heard that either, Dan. And, you know, people respond. You know, I have a very similar experience. It was a little different. People didn't bring me food. They just said, invited me out to lunch and dinner. And I accepted all of it because people want to help.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're, you know, they just want to help. They loved Dan as much as a friend or a colleague or you know, any other person would love. So it was just very overwhelming, and all the people, it was like 115 people that came to his memorial. Was we're practicing Buddhists, and so it was the first Buddhist ceremony that I had ever been to.
My first Buddhist ceremony too.
Yeah,
we have something in common.
Yeah, so people were just very overwhelming, and it was really that part. I'll never forget that part.
Well, I remember Julie's memorial, her funeral, and in the service before. Julie passed away on the day that George Bush was inaugurated, because remember we had the contested results.
Right.
And so that was an interesting thing to follow in the fall when Julie was sick. But Julie passed away, and what was interesting is Julie and I had lived in Washington, D.C. for a year. In 1995-96 school year, we took a leave of absence and moved to Washington, D.C. for a year. And we just love that city. That's a real special place for us. And I can talk about, if we take a break here in a moment, why that is. But I remember Julie, I don't mind saying this, she supported Al Gore. She was very much an environmentalist. And so I remember I was I was scheduled to speak, and I mean, there was just, oh, I don't know, hundreds of people. I've never spoken in such a big audience, and I felt like Julie was right there with me. There was like no fear. I just jumped right up there. In fact, people had called me afterwards saying, "Oh my God, that was amazing." But I had sort of like prepared some remarks, and then I just sort of winged this, and I don't know if I should even say this, but I'm gonna. So I get up there and I said, because there's some hardcore Republicans in our family, and I said, "So I guess we know what Julie thinks of George Bush." And all of a sudden there was like slow, muffled laughter, and then all of a sudden like a wave, it just like over the thing. And then I said, "Sorry, Mom." And then everybody just sort of lightened up, and I think it sort of made for as good a day as it could be. So,
yeah. All right, we've had a break, had some water and some caffeine, and we're getting ready.
Fresh air out some in the backyard.
And I did want. I wanted a beer. Not gonna lie,
we'll do that after the show. But we, you know, we wanted to bring this all back to money. And financial things and financial our financial lives. And so I want to start with you, Dan. Your story was so compelling, and one of the things that I thought about during while I was listening to your story was, here you are, your wife was a teacher bringing in an income, you were still a teacher bringing in an income, and suddenly, you know, Julie can't teach anymore. And not only that, you are one of her primary caretakers. Can you kind of walk us through, how did you survive that financially? Because that has to be very difficult. You have so much on your mind, and then you got to figure out how to make ends meet at the same time.
That's a great question, Scott. And I, first of all, was so fortunate for a couple of reasons. I had unbelievable family and friend support. My parents were living in Pittsburgh, just outside of Pittsburgh at the time. My dad was his last assignment before retirement. So my mom moved in with us because Lily was one and a half when Julie was diagnosed. So she lived with us. Julie's parents, her dad and her stepmom, eventually got an apartment near us, and they delayed their retirement. But the other, and we had just phenomenal friends around. Her brother Greg was in the area. Her brother Chris was in the area. So we had a lot of support from family and friends. But I also was so lucky to be a teacher. If I had been in a different profession where I'm leaving for work at 7 and getting home at 7, that would have been brutal. So I was on a year-round schedule, so I would have a month off every 3 months. So that was important. But the other thing was, Julie had disability insurance, I think, which is part of her employment. And because she didn't have many so-called sick days, because she used that, or vacation days, she used that for Lily's birth. You know, in our country, we don't give women a lot of time after birth. And so we were very fortunate again to be teachers. So we had that, and we actually had a fight for it. Okay. It was unbelievable. All of a sudden, the checks stopped after a couple months. And I remember calling the disability company, and I wish I remembered their name. And the lady on the other line said, because I'm like, what's going on? You know, my wife has cancer. She cannot work. She's getting high-dose chemotherapy. And we need this money. And the lady, I'm not kidding you, said, "Well, I'm sick too. I've got cancer." It was the most crass, flippant delivery. I just was blown away. And so what I did was I got a hold of our union. Our union, Corona Norco Unified School District, I forget what the union was actually called, they wrote a letter on behalf of the union within 3 days saying, if this continues, we will lobby to go with a different disability company. And I think this was insurance that you got as part of employment. And if you wanted to add more, you can. And all of a sudden, those checks started flowing again. So we did get that. So while Julie was sick, we were getting, I think, 60% of her salary. And then I was working...
when she was sick.
So you were still able to work most of the time?
Most of the time. Once Julie passed away, I just made the decision to stay home. And, you know, we can save this for later, but, you know, the timing turned out to be really lucky for us. I read in 1998 Suze Orman's book, mm-hmm. 9 Steps to Financial Freedom, and one of them was get term life insurance. Probably if I had to do it again, I would have gotten a lot more money, but we had term life insurance, and I said, I'm going to live on that so I can be home for Lily. So we were so fortunate to have read that book, and I kind of feel with my website, this is a way for me to pay it forward, you know, providing this kind of information, because again, I know people are mixed on Suze Orman. I don't love her TV shows, but I thought she had a lot of really pragmatic advice, and that was very influential on me.
I agree. I think 9 mm-hmm. Steps to Financial Freedom continues to be one of the better financial books out there. I have my problems with Suze Orman as well. I have a tough time watching her show, but or listening to her.
She's very different on TV. I mean, some of the things she says to the people that call in that want help, she says, "You're doing it all wrong."
She doesn't have strong opinions, does she?
But we love her. But we love her.
Have you seen the Saturday Night Live spoofs on her?
Oh no, I'm gonna have to pull
that
out.
They are genius. Mm. Google Suze Orman Saturday Night Live, and you are in for some entertainment.
But actually, I think I'm glad you mentioned that book because I read it, and as a financial planner, I thought it was a fantastic book, and I people should read that book. Still, it's probably her best book.
We got a will because of it.
Okay. Did you really?
We had the, I forget what it was, a medical provision.
Like a living will?
Living will. So we had a living will all because of that. I remember the attorney, because Julie was 27, I was 29. The attorney, I remember him saying, I am so impressed that you're doing this at this age. Most of my clients are older, things have happened, and they wish they had gone through to do this. And we went with a full attorney, paid the full fee. It felt like that would be money well spent, and I don't regret that at all.
What would you say to, I guess, not just young couples, but couples 30s, 40s, about life insurance?
Do it, and get term life insurance. Don't fall for this whole life insurance. Don't mix investing and insurance. Term life insurance is unbelievably cheap. I think we were paying $17 a month, and I'm not going to say the dollar figure. Again, I would have done much more, but it allowed me to stay home with Lily, and that was, you cannot put a price on that when you have a young child to be able to be home for them. So if you don't have life insurance, the internet has made it so easy to search. I've always used Charles Schwab as a brokerage company. I really trusted them. So I bought the life insurance through them, but I think it was maybe John Hancock, I think. And, you know, when Julie passed away, I was in a total fog, and I was lucky to have a dad who's very financially savvy, and he said, I'm taking all this off your plate. He called the life insurance company. We got a check pretty quick. I don't know exactly, 2 to 4 weeks. That's pretty wild to get a check all of a sudden. He called Social Security because there was some Social Security support. He handled a lot of that stuff for me. So again, you've heard that term, it takes a village. I was so lucky. I would tell people out there, surround yourself with good people because you're going to need to lean on them at some point. And I plan to be there for other people.
Yeah, what is that called? Because my mother got Social Security for mm-hmm. me when my father died when I was 13.
It's for Lily, and she gets it till she's 18, and she turns 18 this April. We're recording this in March 2016, so she only gets it for another month.
I guess they changed the law, because as long as I was in college, my mother kept getting it.
Oh, really? Yeah, so they
up until 22,
it.
I think.
That's
that
what
we're talking about 40 years ago, though.
Sure. No, and I don't know like what it also could be, because Julie was part of Social Security. So we've been getting a stipend Julie was part of CalSTRS in California. So she's been getting a stipend. We've been getting a stipend in Lily's name, and it's till age 22. And I've used a good portion of that money for saving for college. But teachers are so lucky in so many ways. We have defined benefit plans, and there's a support structure for these kind of things that I don't know if other industries have that. And ironically, a couple years before Julie got sick, I just felt like, you know what, I want to try something else. I want to do something different than teaching. And I actually, I know I never told either of you this, I interviewed for a medical sales job. And I kept progressing from one thing to the next thing. And the farther along I went, the more like, cold fingers or just more like, I'm like, this is not right for me. This is not right for me. I am so glad that I did not get that job. They would not, I would have been hired, and a year later my wife gets cancer. They would not have afforded me the kind of time and resources that I got from my school. I was really lucky.
Yeah. Steve, let me ask you a few questions. So, so you have a benefit from the California State Teachers Retirement System. You retired from California, from a California school, a Los Angeles Unified School District. And actually, I don't know that. So, did you ever contribute to Social Security?
Yes, I did. I worked in the private sector.
So you worked in the private sector.
Okay. Before I went into teaching, and I qualified for my own benefit, my own Social Security.
Now, so what if you don't mind me asking, what option did you choose when you retired? Did you take did you have the option to take a survivor benefit?
If something happened to me, he was going to get half of my benefit.
Okay.
And so since that didn't happen, then I sent them the death certificate of Dan, and so it went back. My benefit went up
to
the unmodified version. Okay. And so
But when because you receive, so this is a unique situation for teachers who receive a government pension and who are married to someone who receives Social Security benefits. You're affected by what's called the government pension offset. And I think we're going to do a whole episode on this at some point in time. You're also affected by the windfall elimination provision, but that's another topic. So the government pension offset essentially makes it so you will not receive... When Dan passed away, so did his Social Security.
Exactly.
For the most part, you probably won't receive a survivor benefit from Social Security from Dan.
Yeah, I went to the Social Security Administration office here, and you're exactly right. His he only had Social Security, so his benefit was a lot more than what I'm going to get, and I'm not eligible for any of it as a survivor because I have a pension, a teacher's pension.
Wow. Yeah. So for our listeners, the government pension offset essentially says if you get a government pension, then you can only get a spousal or a survivor benefit from Social Security, so a benefit based on your spouse. If you only get the amount of Social Security that exceeds 2/3 of your government pension, which for most longtime teachers essentially means they get nothing.
Right. Yeah.
And so I know you guys have done some great savings, but tell us how does that affect things financially for you?
Well, you know, I was, 68 and Dan was 74 and we were both retired and we did have life insurance. I agree with Dan Otter that I have to mention your last name because people are going to get confused with my Dan. There's two Dans going on here get life insurance. But as soon as we retired, though, I let it go. I let the life insurance go because we didn't need it anymore. And many spouses, couples, have a problem with their finances when one knows about how to invest and manage the account, and that person dies, then the other person doesn't know anything.
Right.
Dan and I ran across widows at these free dinners.
There's people preying on them all over the place.
It's terrible. So, but that wasn't our situation because Dan and I, both of us knew how to invest. So
you wrote a book together.
Yeah. So that wasn't an issue at all. We had plenty of money, and there was no medical cost because we had an HMO, And since it was, the whole hospital stay was so quick, it was only 8 days compared to what you had with Julie as far as a year. And, I'm so lucky in terms of medical health coverage. I have two plans. I'm a veteran.
Right.
So I have the VA.
Yeah.
As well as I retired from Los Angeles Unified School District, and they're one of four districts in California that has medical coverage, that has health benefits. So I have that. And Dan was covered under that too. So I had no bill at all from HMO, even in the emergency at Eisenhower Hospital. And with all of our money in Vanguard, Dan and I had just set up our wills so that each one of us were taken care of. And so the transfer, Vanguard, no problem. You had the beneficiaries were in each other's name. And so everything was transferred over. Now, Dan had to take mandatory distributions. Mm-hmm. Well, as it turns out, I don't have to do that
right.
This year. Last year, I had to do that because he was still alive. So so I have to declare some distributions for him from last year. The only thing that he did that I didn't do was taxes. And so I learned about TurboTax. And we had used TurboTax back in the 90s, and it was a very klutzy program back then. And I gave up because, and he retired, and so he had more time to do the taxes. So he did all the taxes. He would have the dining room table filled with all these papers. He did it by hand, and he loved it.
What's snail taxes?
And
he did his taxes by hand?
Did our taxes by hand.
Wow.
He loved it, and he was good at it, too. So this year, I went into TurboTax, and I looked at what he did last year, and followed the same kind of format, only I use Excel to put in all of our expenses and all that stuff. And then Vanguard makes it easy too with TurboTax. You can import.
Pull it right in.
Pull the reports, the brokerage reports, the IRAs, pull it right into TurboTax, and it calculates the distributions, the capital gains. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's great.
And so I essentially got my taxes done. And now if I'm going to get audited, the TurboTax says I have a very small chance of getting audited. So that's the part. So I'm doing that. And I get a benefit, compensation because I got wounded in Nam. So I get a 30% disability. Now being married, I get a little bit more. So I had to report to the VA that Dan had passed. And so my benefit there was reduced by $50. And Dan did, we both have long-term insurance, but he died before the 3 months. There was a three-month deductible or whatever, three-month delay before the benefit came in. This part that was hard to do was to remove his name from our checking accounts and for Vanguard, just removing his name was hard. I mean, here, that means this is really, he's gone. And but the money part, I'm very fortunate that the money part was transferred over very quickly and promptly. Vanguard was very good about all of it and helped me how to do it. So, trust. Since we got married in 2008, I've mentioned this before, we had a living trust before that because unmarried couples need a trust so that our common shared property would get transferred over in case something happened to us. Now, being legally married, boy, that really, nobody asks questions.
Yeah.
There is no delay. So if you're a gay couple out there and you're thinking about having your assets stay within the couple in case something happens to you, get legally married, because it really carries a lot of weight, that marriage certificate. And then Now, I continued on. I created another trust because Dan and I had a list of charities that we want to give to in case something happened to both of us. Now, it's only me, and I wanted to continue that. So I did hire an attorney, and I started another trust. And there are, you know, some relatives that can't handle lump sum monies. They're going to get a payout over 5 years instead of a lump sum. So all that is taken care of. And so that cost about $2,000 to create that trust.
How much did you leave to 403bys? Is that it? Cut that off. Okay. So.
It's a for-profit.
Yeah. No, I'm joking. So you had long-term care. Now long-term care becomes an even more important benefit for you. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot, I'm talking about long-term care insurance, and I hear a lot of people say, I don't want to pay on a premium all those years and then, you know, just die and not be able to get to use it. Mm-hmm. Kind of forgetting that we pay for fire insurance, hoping that we don't use it.
I know those statistics.
You know, you don't want to, nobody buys insurance because they want to use it. It's we buy insurance for the off chance that something does happen. So you don't regret buying, do you regret buying long-term care insurance and paying those premiums and not being able to use them, Steve?
No.
No.
It was about $1,000 a year for Dan.
That is actually a very good price.
And the payout is like 2 years, $100 a day, $3,000 a month.
Okay.
So it's not,
it was capped at,
it's not full coverage.
But you still have coverage.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And now it's even more important now that you have coverage. So.
Exactly, yeah. And the VA does also have a benefit too, but my assets have to be down under $50,000 or something like that. So
you have to sell the Tesla
and the house and all the money in there.
403bys would take.
We'll take the Tesla. Let me come back to something that we had talked about, and it's a little off topic financially, but actually, no, it's not. I told you a story about a client that I had, and there's a whole bigger story there. This is really the client that kind of turned me around in some, I think, backward thinking in my life many, many years ago. I had a client who came in, and he had... not a spouse, but he had a partner. This was in California before, you know, it was legal to get married. And he told me this horrific story of how his partner got into an accident and he was in the hospital for months. And his partner's parents hated him because they didn't approve of him being gay. And it's just him telling me the story, I just broke down listening to it, because here you are, the person you love is in the hospital, and you're fighting just to be able to see them and be with them. And he eventually passed away, and it was a real struggle for him, and it was very hurtful, and it really made me realize what the hell was going on. I didn't know this was a thing. I think things have improved since then, and just kind of the ease with which you were able to, you know, you had full access to Dan, and you're married now and all this transition. But, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you had to be a little more, how do I say, it had to freak you out a little bit more. I mean, how did you view things back then, and how have things changed since?
Well, Kaiser has always been proactive in this. They've always, 15 years ago when I had my surgery, Dan and I went to Kaiser to make sure Dan was my health care directive. And Kaiser was very good about that. There was no question, and this is in Los Angeles at the Kaiser there, there was no question that Dan could see me. There was no issue at all. And so, we didn't have that experience about visiting, because we weren't in the hospital, you know,
right,
over the years. We didn't have that issue with Kaiser. As far as I know, they've always been good.
Talk about how things have changed in terms of assets and property. I mean, up until really not that long ago, you wouldn't have been able to roll over your Dan's IRA into exactly. your own IRA. Yeah. So talk about assets and how that has changed.
Well, take the house.
Okay.
Before you're legally, we were legally married, the house would have to be reassessed.
Oh, my goodness.
And so...
So your property taxes would go up.
Property taxes would go up. And then so that I would be the sole owner of the house. That was a big deal back in the days. And I don't know about the IRAs. You know, there's some say that they would have to be taxable, and others say, no, there's a five-year delay.
You would have you would have had to take it out at a maximum over 5 years.
Okay,
but you would have had to take it out of the IRA and take it as income. Right. Now you can roll it over as a spousal right into your own IRA,
and that's what happened.
Yeah.
And then when I turn 70 and a half in 2 years, then I start my mandatory distribution.
Required minimum distributions.
Required minimum distributions. Thank you.
Aren't you excited about that?
Sure. More money to spend. Buy another Tesla.
Hey, well, at the end of this month, you could put a down payment on the Tesla 3, right? Is that what it's called?
No, the X.
The
swinging
door. No. Their new...
The three?
Yeah, it's not going to be in production until 17 or 18, but you can put a down payment on. That's the economical one. So it's supposed to start at $35,000.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go.
So there you go.
You ready for one, Dan?
Yeah.
I definitely am. I'm ready for... I told Scott I read the Time Magazine articles on self-driving cars. I am so for this. Bring it on. Yeah.
Be a lot less accidents. Human error.
Red light running... What do I say? I say, cars make good people bad and bad people worse.
Yeah, we almost got ran over on our way here by some person driving a truck with the horses attached to it.
And with the caution horses sticker on the back, but you know, no caution for people.
None whatsoever. Man. So let's see. From a... How long, Dan? I'll redirect this to you. How long till you started thinking about money on your own? It actually wasn't that long that you started the website 403B. I mean, you had already started it, but you kind of started focusing on it more. But how long till you really started thinking about money, and what did that entail?
That's a great question. And you hate, I'm sure Steve shares this feeling, you hate this idea of mixing the loss of a loved one in money. And so getting that check from term insurance, it's what's going on in your head, right? You lose this person, and then you get a check. But then you have to step back. And I think my dad said it, well, do you wish you didn't have this money and you couldn't stay home with Lily? You have to look at it that way, that money's there. I would say it probably took me, gosh, I don't know. It's a good question. I think when I... My school told me to take as much time as I needed, and then I think I went back for like the last month. Oh, I know what happened. One of my really good friends, I actually had taught her third grader in Corona. She was a professor at Cal State Fullerton, and then I think I told you guys this when we took our break. We just got terrible news that her husband was just diagnosed with brain cancer, and they're in their mid-50s, so... Just terrible stuff. And she came to my funeral, and then she sent me a note saying, if you would ever want to teach at Cal State Fullerton, because I had just gotten my master's degree there, let me know. We'd be happy to have you. And I felt like I needed more flexibility for Lily. So I would say, Scott, 3 months later, I really started putting pen to paper saying, can I afford to leave this full-time, you know, K-12 teaching job and maybe teach part-time at a college? 403B-wise, we weren't making any money at that point. You know, we were getting some nice national mentions, but because of the term and life insurance, and then my dad helped me with that. So I would say several months after that, we began to put sort of calculations, and we thought, yeah, we can pull this off. And again, as I said earlier, I was lucky to be a teacher, to have certain things available to me.
You know, I hear a lot of people say, because I'm constantly... telling friends, you know, I don't sell insurance or life insurance. And I'm constantly telling couples that you guys got to both get life insurance. It's not enough for whoever the breadwinner is to have life insurance. You need to both have life insurance. And I keep hearing this, well, my spouse stays home with the kids, whether the spouse, you know, nowadays it could be the man or the woman. And, you know, if they pass away, then, you know, I can still work. I can still produce an income. And my response is exactly what you just said, Dan. Yeah, you can. You could do that. But is that what you want to do? I mean, don't you want that flexibility? Maybe it is. Maybe you do want to go back to work right away. But wouldn't it be better to have some flexibility? And it sounds like that life insurance provided that flexibility to you. And it was... Maybe you had some guilt associated with it at first, but without it, it would have made things a lot more difficult. And for $17 a month?
You are 100% correct, Scott. And again, for younger teachers out there, younger anyone out there, the earlier you get it, the cheaper it is. You really can't have too much. Like, Scott, how would you advise people? Do you have like a dollar amount, or is it all on their income? Is there a formula for someone who out there, let's say, wants to get term and life insurance? Do you quadruple their salary? That's
one of the formulas out there, 4x salary. But remember, if you're buying, you know, for a, say, a stay-at-home spouse, there's no salary. So you want to look, at your own salary for them as well. Mm-hmm. So you really want to look at what sort of things do you want to pay off? What type of flexibility do you want to have if something does happen? Mm-hmm. I just went through this with another not incredibly young couple, but you know, they wanted to have the mortgage paid off if something happened, because that gives them a lot of flexibility. And they wanted to have at least some money to start a college fund, or maybe even to pay off to pay for college. And then they wanted to have some like flex time money that they could take time off of work for 6 months or so. So I encourage people to just write down their goals of, you know, if something were to happen to each of you, what do you want to have covered? And so that's a little more, that's a longer way of doing things rather than just giving a rule of thumb. But it really goes to the values of each individual couple, because not everybody's the same. They have different goals and different things that they want to do. And then it's choosing the term. I always have gone with a 20 or 30 year term. What I try to do is I get my life insurance to expire about when I'm going to retire. It's more expensive, and not everybody likes to do this. But the reason I do it this way is because, let's say I'm 25 years old and I get a $1 million policy on my life for 10 years. That's great, as long as something happens to me by 35. If I get a 30-year policy, yes, I'm paying a lot more for that policy. But I know that no matter what happens between 25 and 55, I'm covered. I don't have to go back for another checkup to see if I qualify. This is all about qualifying for insurance. If you are 34 years old and you are 1 year away from your policy expiring, you go in and guess what? They're doing the blood work on you and they find out that there's something wrong and you can't get life insurance. How much money did you really save yourself? Not that much. So I always encourage more than a 10-year policy. I try, you know, if you're 50 years old and you can get a good 10-year policy, that's fine. If you're looking to retire at around 60 or 65. But so like right now, when I turned 25, I was already married for 3 years and we were about to have a kid. I had a 30-year policy to get me to 55. But as soon as I turned 30, I knew I was going to replace those policies to get myself to 60. And that's what we did. And I also bought it for my wife. My wife is a teacher. So I would, you know, you don't hear this from a lot of planners, but I tend towards longer term insurance policies. I'm not permanent. I'm not a big fan of whole life. I think permanent policies have their place. That's a whole nother
podcast. So if you get a 25-year policy, it's easy to extend it.
It's not easy. Once you come to the end of that 25 years.
No, I mean at the beginning, like you did.
You usually have to replace it. You just get a brand new policy when you turn. So like I got a 30-year policy when I was 25. And then when I hit 30, I got a brand new 30-year policy.
Like laddering it all. Oh, no, you replaced
it. I replaced the entire one. Because here's the other thing. Life insurance policies are constantly dropping in price.
Yes.
Because of... It sounds strange that my prices would be lower at 30 than they are at 25. Because technically my chance of dying has gone up. But...
what, accidents is...
You have a higher probability of having an accident than dying. And that's why disability insurance is so important as well. Because of because of science and all the breakthroughs that we've had, people are living longer. And so mortality rates are going up, which means that the prices of life insurance is going down. And, you know, something like 90, 95, 98% of term insurance expires, you know, without paying out a benefit. Well, I'm okay with that as long as I'm covered for the time period that I need. And if my financial plan goes well enough, even if it doesn't go well enough by the time I'm 60 or maybe 65, I'm not going to need that life insurance. That's kind of the point of it. I'm not sure how we got onto that. But the point being that life insurance is so important, not only for technical the breadwinner, but for a stay-at-home spouse as well.
For options.
Yeah, to give you that flexibility. And especially, it just doesn't cost that much.
Yeah. And when you're in grief, you don't feel like working. It's you know, people react different ways. Like you, Dan, did deal with it by working.
Mm-hmm. While she was, during the treatment. You know what's interesting, too, with term life insurance? You don't pay taxes on that. Right. You don't think whoever, you know, didn't tax that, thank you. I think that's because it can really change, especially if you have a big, big number. It could change your tax bracket.
Absolutely. Let me just kind of ask an opening question. What was a surprise to you financially? Was there anything that was a surprise to you financially?
A surprise?
Yeah. What didn't you expect?
I have to think about that. I don't...
Something that was... strange, and it makes sense, and you mentioned this term, was the need for a death certificate. I remember we were talking to the funeral people, and they said, we'll go ahead and order death certificates. And I must have missed that in financial books I'd read. And then when, you know, my dad called for the life insurance, we need a death certificate.
Right. And different things. Different, Vanguard needed a death, CalSTRS.
And it just hits you different ways because, as you said, it's a finality. And my dad tried to take as much of that off my plate as possible. But that's like those little reminders of this person. I remember about 2 weeks after Julie passed away, my friends took me out to Warner Springs here, not far from like Temecula, to play golf and just sort of hang out. And I just had the best time. And I remember going upstairs to our bedroom. And then I heard something downstairs. It was my mom. I just felt like it was Julie coming up. And I couldn't wait to tell her about what a great weekend I had. And I don't know if you've had those experiences, Steve. It's just like, and it's just, I mean, I can say without a doubt, I think of Julie every single day. But it was, here's another interesting thing. I cried a lot, you know, for a period of time. But I remember one day waking up. Or like when I went to bed that night going, wow, I feel like I'm not as emotional right now about losing Julie. And I actually missed it. There was a comfort in the grief because I felt like closer to her because I was grieving so much. Just like earlier in this podcast, when I was telling that story, it was almost a weird reconnection with her. And that's an interesting thing. You're only 5 years or 5 months out, Steve, but I can tell you, you will still think about this person every single day. And I don't know if we're going to touch on this, and if anyone's listening here, one of the most helpful things for me, and I don't know how I got put in touch with this person, but he was basically my age. He was living in Corona. He had recently lost his wife. She had had a heart attack and died suddenly. And he broached the topic of me dating someone else. And you need that door open for you. And Julie and I had conversations. If anything happened, life is for the living and we expect it. that was enormously helpful for me. My dad, same thing. I remember saying, that's it, I'm done, I'm never getting married, I'm never going through this again. And this was maybe like a few days after she passed away. And then my dad said, hold on, give it time. Do you really want Lily, you know, to have you dating a series of people? Do you want that for her? Take your time. Julie would support this. And so Julie passed away in January. My parents were living in Pittsburgh. I went back that summer to Pittsburgh, and Julie and I still had really good friends in Washington, D.C., and one of her best friends was a woman named Amanda. And so I took Lily to Washington to connect with, you know, Mandy and some other friends, and it just so happened that she had just broken up from a long-time relationship, and one thing led to another, and Mandy and I are now married. And in some ways, I feel like Julie led me to her. I mean, I'm sort of, you know, who knows the afterlife? I mean, I, you know, who knows? I hope it's there. But when we were teaching in California, she wanted to take a leave of absence and move to an East Coast city and live in a city and not have a car and experience the East Coast because she grew up in California. She worked with Mandy. And I'll never forget our first day of her working, she came home and said, you got to meet this person. She's amazing. She loves to mountain bike. And that's when I was getting into mountain biking. And my wife, Julie, was someone who was lucky enough to have all her cousins in California living near her. And they saw them each other regularly. So Julie is not a person that had a lot of like friends because she didn't need to. She had this big family, which is unique in California. Most Californians have family spread around the country. And so it was almost like Julie had sort of checked out Mandy for me in a way. If Julie was friends with her, then you knew this was a good person. And so what was great was we communicated via this new technology called internet and email. So I was back home taking care of Lily, and Mandy and I were exchanging emails. And so I think about, I was lucky to get to know her better that way, as opposed to immediately dating right away. So again, that's just something I wrote down that I wanted anybody out there listening. And again, Steve, I don't know if it's too early to talk about this kind of thing for you, but I've definitely told Mandy, if anything happens to me, I fully hope and expect you date and find someone, because I want you to be as happy as you can.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same thing with Dan and I. Dan told me before he died, you know, you're going to go out and make mistakes and all that stuff. After, you know, he told me that he was sorry that he was leaving me behind. And, you know, so, and I would have said the same thing to him. You know, just don't stay home and feel sorry for yourself. I mean, you know, that's the simplest way of putting it. And so I don't know if he's helping me like you're doing now, but I do have a picture of him in my bedroom, and I talk to him every day about what's happening, like we did before. That's the thing I miss, is talking about our day, you know, and there's nobody here to talk to. And it's relying on the kindness of strangers, you know, the old cliche. And that's the big transition, is you know, getting out of the house and meeting up with friends. And that's the new life, because there isn't, I don't have that special person right now. And that's a big challenge. Back to your surprise question. I'm surprised that I'm doing my taxes. That was one surprise. The other surprise is the way I'm handling, you know, we didn't have any travel insurance when we went to Vietnam, so we paid $8,000. That was gone. But it doesn't bother me. The way I rationalize it, and all the trips that we did go, we didn't pay premiums. Those premiums are expensive for two people.
Right.
They're up to $800 or $900 per trip.
Wow.
So, and we've gone on, you know, eight or nine trips. So the premiums we saved paid for the $9,000 that I lost in that travel, in going to Vietnam. We didn't. The other thing, which is a lot bigger, And I hadn't mentioned this. Dan had reapplied for his Social Security. He took it out when he was 62.
Okay.
And then he bought it back when he
was
60.
Oh, he did that, huh?
He did do that. It was within the last few months. You can't do it now.
Right.
And it cost $113,000. So this is another podcast, but essentially he paid back Social Security, all the benefits from age 62 to 68 or something like that. And it costs $113,000. You're taking a big risk, because what if something happens? Well, something did happen. And this was like five and a half years ago. Anyway, I calculated, and so I lost about $55,000 out of the $113,000 that's gone to Social Security. The surprise is, I'm not bothered by that either. I have enough money, basically. I mean, you know, and I told Dan I'm going to take real good care of it, and just like I've always been doing, and when I post on 403bys, I tell people, don't take too many risks. And so I'm not bothered by that either. And I think that was a surprise to me, because maybe because of the grief that I'm going through, you know, this is where money and, you know, the Tesla doesn't make me happy.
Right.
I mean, it's okay. Yes, I like it, but it doesn't replace Dan.
Not at all. And we were talking during our break, that one of the things I've learned from both you and Dan Otter is, you know, we have this focus on savings and, you know, trying to be frugal and do
building
the right thing.
Wealth, building slowly wealth slowly over a working career, blah blah blah.
Right. But you know, as you just said, you know, the Tesla's great, you know, Social Security's great, but you guys, we don't know how long we have with the people that are in our lives. And you know, you were lucky enough, Steve, to have Dan for 40 years.
Absolutely, yes.
Dan Otter, you were lucky enough to have Julie in your life for 15 years.
I knew her for a few years before.
And I look at my wife and my kids, and I think to myself, you know, how long am I going to have? I might have them for a long, long time. I might be, you know, they might outlive me, and hopefully they do. But we have to have some balance in our life. And this is the problem I sometimes have with some personal finance that goes a little too far. We talk about building our portfolios, but what about building our portfolio of life experiences with the people that we love and care about? And for me, finding that balance is really what personal finance is about. That's what Teach and Retire Rich is about. Teach and Retire Rich is almost a... It's almost a play on words, because we're not talking about...
Yeah, it's not to be a millionaire. It's to do a career that's very rewarding and retire comfortably. And I feel like, Steve, you're like living this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's about building those life experiences, those moments and time that you will always have with you, even if, you know, that person passes away.
And I have to say, for Julie and I, because we were teachers and we were off every 3 months, we went to England, we went to Canada... We got to do things that we did cross-country trips. We could not have done as many of those if I had 2 weeks off a year, okay? And that, again, is sort of the beauty of teaching. I think it's under assault. I think that we're asking more and more of teachers, too much. I think the class sizes are too large, especially in the state we are in right now. But I do think it can provide a pretty well-rounded lifestyle.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, Dan and I, we went on many trips abroad to Russia, on a Mediterranean cruise on the QE2. And this is what we're saving, too. I mean, but we didn't buy a new car every 3 years. In fact, the first new car I bought was in retirement, was the Leaf, the Nissan Leaf. That's the first new car I've ever owned in my life.
Wow.
And because I couldn't have put money away in the 403B and have a new Beamer. I don't think so.
No.
And I didn't want that. But we invested in life experiences. You know, financial wellness is, I'm starting to hear that's a buzzword now, and I think that's what you're touching on.
Yeah, it's a clever Scotty. It's clever terminology, Scott, this portfolio of life experiences. I mean, that should be right along with your financial portfolio. Mm-hmm. I think I want to touch on, too, is I don't know how long it lasted, but there was this period right after Julie's death where I was so focused and so sure that the only thing that matters was friends and family. And little things didn't get me down. And gradually, as you get back into the so-called rat race, you know, get frustrated by the person running the red light or cutting you off. And I get angered at myself that I've returned to that in somewhat. But again, I feel like I've been able to like step back and really, especially turning 50. 50 impacted me in a way that turning 30 and turning 40 didn't. In fact, Mandy and I went to England for 2.5 weeks, and we came home saying we need to travel more. And so we're trying to move some things around to allow that kind of stuff. But I think you were touching on that, how you weren't bitter about certain money things. That's not what matters.
Right.
No one, it's like, you always hear this, no one on their deathbed says, oh, I should have worked more. Or, I mean, how much money do you need? I'm always blown away by these people that need, like, 1 million's not enough. 2 million, 5 million, 10 billion.
Well, there's been studies done on. The more money you have, the more stress they have.
I agree. And I feel like I've done that to myself to a degree. I've gotten myself buying more than one house. Not a good idea. Anyone out there listening? But anyway.
Well, I want to thank both of you. This has been a very enlightening podcast. It's been difficult. It's been emotional, but I hope it has a big impact for our listeners. It's had a big impact for me. It's been a fantastic afternoon, and you guys are so great. I love you both. I'm glad that you're in my life, and Steve, Dan, and I are here for you. Anything you need, man. And thank you for sharing your story. Dan, thank you for sharing your story. Steve, you are going to be on our podcast again. You're going to be a staple of our podcast going forward.
This is what's been happening. I get closer to people, and I got closer to you two today. And I've known you two for 15 years.
Yeah.
And I've gotten closer to you. And that's a surprise. You know, talk about surprises. I've gotten closer to family and friends. You mentioned that, Dan. You know, a lot closer. Because I was a little estranged from my own family of origin. Even, you know, my sister and I didn't always get along, but now we're closer now, and that was a surprise. Another surprise is, and I'm picking up a little bit of Dan's humor. I have been told a couple of times from people, you know, you have a good sense of humor. I've never been told that before. So that's how Dan's coming through. Anyway, thanks for doing this, you guys. It was
first of all, Scott, I thought your emceeing of this was phenomenal. You asked the right questions. You provide terrific financial information for our listeners. So, Scott, thanks for that. I value your friendship so much, and it's ironic that you came into my life right after Julie had passed away. You came into my life just before to help promote 403BYs. I also want to thank you, Steve. I don't know if I could have done this 5 months after Julie's passing. So you have, I call you the godfather of the 403B. You have paid it forward so many ways with what you have taught us and the courage you've showed on so many fronts. So thank you very much. The last thing I want to say is my brother-in-law, Greg, Julie's brother, I cannot say enough about this guy. When I mentioned Mandy and I were dating, he said, I am so happy for you. It's like I needed that acknowledgement from Greg, and it just made all the difference in the world. So, Greg, if you listen to this, I love you so much, man. So thank you. All right, guys.